I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Colleges and universities received a Dear Colleague letter last year from the Civil Rights Office of the Education Department about their responsibilities to deal with complaints about sexual violence and harassment on their campuses. Federal law requires that colleges and universities report and investigate these incidents, but compliance has been lax in some instances, and most of the students who have been victims of sexual violence don't report the incidents to the authorities. So how can college and university campuses be made safer? What are the responsibilities of administrators, staff, and students? And how should victims and perpetrators be treated? Our topic for today's Radio Times. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studios is Gina Maisto Smith. She's a partner in the litigation department of the Philadelphia law firm of Ballard Spahr. And Gina, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us is Leslie Gomez. She works in the litigation department of the Philadelphia law firm of Ballard Spahr. Leslie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Thank you for the opportunity.
You're welcome. And I should say to our listeners that they are both helping colleges develop policies and procedures to deal with sexual assaults on college campuses. And our third guest is Allison Kiss, Executive Director of Security on Campus, and that's a nonprofit dedicated to the prevention of criminal violence at colleges and universities nationwide. And Allison Kiss, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Gina, let me begin with you. Now, this letter was sent out about a year ago. We're talking about it a year later. Nonetheless, what is the significance of this Dear Colleague letter that went out?
The Dear Colleague letter essentially is a call to action for colleges and universities to take advantage of this opportunity, of this call to action, to address their policies and procedures, to make sure that those policies and procedures are compliant with the Title IX guidelines, and to implement changes as needed. So every school across the country, not only colleges and universities, and I know we're focusing on colleges and universities at the moment, but every school that receives federal financial assistance has been called to action to do just this. The policies and procedures are the tip of the iceberg,
right,
but then the implementation of those, I think, is the place where schools are struggling.
Well, let me just follow up on that. Does this Dear Colleague letter, though, does it or did it change any of the rules and regulations about reporting incidents, investigating incidents, bringing charges?
In fact, it did not. The 2001 guidance was around for 10 years, and the Dear Colleague letter was a 10-year wake-up call for colleges and universities interpreting the 2001 guidance and giving schools some guidelines to actually implement those things. So what's different is the way schools are processing complaints now, and that's what's causing a stir.
Well, Leslie, let me go to you, and you both sent me a PowerPoint presentation that you do when you go to college and university campuses. And I have to say that, and this doesn't work on the radio, but some of the visuals show just how complex some of these laws, these guidelines, these rules and regulations are.
Well, I think sexual assault in general is a complex concept. It's complex for the victim, it's complex for the accused, and it's complex for all of the people's lives that it touches. And when you take this situation, which is very incendiary in nature, people's feelings about it are very volatile, and they change. And so there's not one way that any particular person responds to a sexual assault. We have a criminal justice system that has evolved over hundreds and thousands of years to deal with issues of this nature. And even in the criminal justice system, we're still as late as the late 90s and even now into the 2000s, changing our laws to reflect our current common understanding. We're talking now about colleges and universities across the nation, each of whom is its own universe, if you will, its own city, its own rules that they follow, its own campus mores, and how each of those colleges and universities need to address policy that affects this very difficult area.
Well, let me turn to you, Allison Kiss, and how serious a problem are we talking about if we're talking about sexual violence, sexual assault on a college campus?
Sure. The statistics go, typically right now we're hearing 1 in 5 students are victims of a completed or attempted sexual assault. We also know that on campuses, most of these attacks are student on student. So I think Leslie mentioned the complex nature of responding to a sexual assault in general. Well, here you have the perpetrator, not the stranger coming off the street. You're having either a current partner, a former partner, or actually someone who may be a friend or known to the student. So it's happening. And, you know, one thing we see quite often is students don't know what constitutes a sexual assault. So really having the students understand what is sexual assault, what can they report, and where can they get help.
And what's the role of alcohol, do you think?
Alcohol certainly plays a part by both the perpetrator and the victim in most of the cases that we see. Sometimes one or both are using alcohol. I recently did a program at a college in upstate New York and worked with a young man who was a student running education about sexual assault, and he said he felt it was a victory that students were going to parties saying, I had one drink, I'm not going home with anyone.
Wow.
So it was really good to see him take the ownership of that.
And I want to pick up this with all of you, but you're saying, Allison, that when it comes to students, they're not sure what sexual assault is?
Many times. That's what we see in a lot of our experiences. And working with many chiefs of police on education that they're doing, it's really getting out there the definitions. You know, in the past, there was a lot of focus on risk reduction, how to not be a victim of sexual assault. We're really seeing a change and seeing more education focused on primary prevention. So talking about how to engage the community. So the community knows what a sexual assault is, and the community knows how to stand up if they see it happening, if it's happening at a fraternity house, at an off-campus party, really knowing when to step in and when to speak up and say, hey, you can't get consent now.
What's sexual assault, Gina?
What I'd like to say about sexual assault is there are a variety of definitions across our states that define sexual assault criminally. And the Title IX regulations are pretty clear with a broad definition of sexual assault. That's not the issue. The issue is the coordination of the various laws that inform this process. There are a labyrinth of laws and regulations, and that has to be incorporated with school policy. Mm-hmm. And incorporating that with school policy, that has to be organized and coordinated among school constituencies, like campus law enforcement, like the Title IX coordinators, like victims' advocates. And that has to be, from an institutional standpoint, applied in a Solomonic way, in a balanced way, because the institution now has become a mini court. Prosecutors' offices have the discretion in credibility cases and word-against-word cases to not proceed. And they can accept the request of a victim to not proceed because right. They don't have a case.
Right.
In a college and university setting, schools are called upon to take some action, maybe not a full-blown investigation, but some action in every case. So now schools, colleges, and universities are the safety net for all of this, and they are becoming akin to mini courts. But academic institutions are not courts, and academic institutions don't have the capacity to be courts or the expertise or the toolbox. And so they are left with having to respond in every allegation of sexual misconduct, yet not necessarily equipped with the tools, the expertise, the resources, or the capacity.
Let me turn to you, Leslie. And everything we read is that most victims do not report an incidence of sexual violence. What is a university or college supposed to do if you have a, not just a reluctant victim, but someone who literally does not want to report what happened to them? Can they be coerced?
No, you can never coerce a victim into reporting. What you can do is educate and inform, and you empower young women and young men by giving them information. And so the best thing that a school can do is to very publicly, very widely, and very clearly understood language put out a policy that says, if you believe that you are a victim of sexual harassment, you may report. You may report confidentially to sources such as health services, counseling, or clergy, but if you report to another individual at the university, a dean, an administrator, a faculty member, or your RA, the school has some responsibility to investigate your report that you've made. Coming back a little bit earlier to your question about what is sexual assault,
yes.
At its most basic level, sexual harassment is unwelcome conduct of a sexual nature. And in the context of the institutional setting, that limits or interferes with a student's ability to participate in the educational activities or educational program. And when you look specifically at sexual violence is an act that occurs without consent or while the victim is incapacitated. And so while alcohol plays a role, it's not the mere fact of intoxication, but it's once you've drank to the point of incapacitation. And schools struggle with how to legislate, if you will, yes. The role between alcohol and sexual assault, alcohol and consent, and schools are really trying to find the language such that the policies they put in place are fair to both parties. They've put the standards of behavior out in advance so students understand when they're called to the carpet, if you will, what standards they'll be held accountable for.
Well, let me turn back to you, Allison, which is why don't students report? I mean, what holds them back or what prevents them from reporting an incident?
To generalize, I would say not knowing the process is something that I typically see when we work with students. If they're not really sure what will happen, if a student was intoxicated and could not legally consent, they may not know that, but they may fear that they were drinking underage, and what's that going to mean? And many times, actually all times, campuses will not cite them for underage drinking, and they'll look at the sexual assault mm-hmm. primarily. But the students need to know that. So it's really important that they know how the institution is defining a sexual assault, where they can report that, where they can get information. We talk a lot about looking beyond the numbers. There are numbers that campuses have to report under the Clery Act for how many sexual assaults, forcible sex offenses occur on their campus. When we get calls from students and parents who say ABC University reports 0, DEF reports 15, DEF is unsafe, we tell them quite the opposite. DEF is breaking down that culture of silence, and they're doing the things that both Gina and Leslie talked about. They're out there educating. They're being proactive. They have a coordinated community response, a sexual assault response team, prevention education at its best. So students know that when they go forward and they report, that the complaints are handled in a prompt manner, they're equitable, and they're handled really victim-centered, looking at what the victim needs and giving her or him what options they have.
Well, I'm also wondering whether there's some degree of embarrassment that might hold somebody back, or the fact
sure.
that the person that violated you is a friend, or they're your friends of their friends, so that it feels it's personal in a way that stranger assault is not.
Sure, there certainly, and even with stranger assault, I think there's a lot of sometimes minimization that may go on. There's a lot of self blame, doubt there, and there's no typical reaction. So, we do quite a bit of educating with conduct boards in particular that you're not always going to have a victim curled up crying in the corner of a room. She or he may laugh, may kind of act out in different ways, and that's all. There's just a variety of responses that someone can have to trauma.
We're almost up in a break here, but Gina, it looks like you want to say something.
Well, I just wanted to say that the incorporation of understanding the dynamics of victims' behavior is very important. But that incorporation is to the backdrop and the knowledge that schools carry into their processes and procedures. What's difficult then is the next step, and that is the fact finders or the conduct boards or whoever they use, and schools have a choice as to who they want to use to hear these cases, but whoever they use understand that the statistics and the background information merely informs our processes, but cannot be used as a substitute for good judgment in every case, because you never know if you have a rape or if you have a false report.
We're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation with Gina Maisto-Smith, Leslie Gomez, and Allison Kiss, and we are talking about the problem of sexual assaults on college campuses and what to do about it. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, introducing the new 2013 Lincoln MKS with available 16-speaker THX surround sound and independent suspension. More at Lincoln.com. Lincoln, now it gets interesting.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. Since 1918, the Philadelphia Foundation has strengthened children and families. The Foundation supports nonprofit organizations that enhance parenting, mentor youth, create safe environments, advance individual education, and advocate for children and families. The Foundation can help you make a difference for such southeastern Pennsylvania nonprofits today and forever while you receive tax deductions. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or fellowfound.org.
WHYY-FM. You listen, you enjoy, and you know you're going to make a donation. So why not just do it now? And if you do, you can enjoy YStream, our regular WHYY-FM programming delivered online without membership breaks. Sign up for YStream by April 22nd. For more information and to make your donation now, visit whyy.org/YStream.
Programming is supported by 21st Century Cyber Charter School, providing public online education for grades 6 through 12, utilizing the latest information and communication technology. More information at 21stcenturycyber.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Allison Kiss, Director of Security on Campus, a nonprofit organization working to prevent criminal violence at colleges and universities across the country. Leslie Gomez works in the litigation department of the Philadelphia law firm of Ballard Spahr. Gina Maisto-Smith is partner in the litigation department of Ballard Spahr, and both of them have been working with colleges and universities, developing policies and procedures to deal with the problem of sexual assaults on campuses. We are also taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Leslie, this is in no way to excuse sexual assault, but I'm also thinking about young people away from home for the first time. They might be drinking, you know, and drinking in a more serious way than they did when they were away from home. They don't have their parents there. They feel a kind of freedom that they may not understand. Do you think this also fuels this opportunity and problem of sexual assault? And you know, people of varying maturities.
Absolutely. And Marty, we actually use the term the perfect storm when we're talking about sexual assault on college campuses. We have a population of 17 to 25-year-olds. They are sexually at their peak. Alcohol is available and its use is glorified. In particular, its excess use is glorified. Red Solo Cup is probably the most popular product on college campuses right now. And students are at an age where they are trying to fit into a new community, forming their own identities as adults, and sexual exploration is very natural to this population. And when you take the overlay of rooms with doors that lock and no parents, we're going to end up with bad behavior. And unfortunately, alcohol exasperates that, but it's not an excuse, and it never will be.
And I mean, there's, you know, hooking up is the term that's often used about the kind of sexual encounters that can often happen between young people. And the problems that can come from that.
Sure. And you know, one study I always direct to is Dr. David Lisak, who's from University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He did quite a bit of research called The Undetected Rapist. And what he did was he interviewed young men, college men, who described what they thought were sexual encounters, when really what they were describing met the legal definition of sexual assault or rape. And they really had this process in terms of prepping their victims. You know, primarily they were looking for freshmen, first-year students. They would be sure to give them drinks at parties, at off-campus parties, kind of drink the yes out of them, quote-unquote, although they were not getting any sort of consent. And we know legally they cannot consent when you're under the influence of alcohol. So really, it was groundbreaking research, and the field is talking about it quite a bit because we've seen that shift to campuses taking ownership and stepping in when they see something going on. We also find out that many of these perpetrators are serial. So many of the young men in his study were doing this more than once. You know, the good news that came out was that most men do not rape. Right. But the ones who are on campuses are serial perpetrators. Because it's not reported, because it's not getting out there, they're doing it over and over again.
I mean, you're describing predator
exactly.
behavior.
It's predatory behavior.
Gina, let me go back to you. And when you look at this letter and the laws and Title IX and all the things that we have been talking about, is this, I guess, rules, regulations, laws that empower the victim? The idea is to give the victim a chance to challenge and go after someone that has sexually assaulted them.
That's correct. The Dear Colleague letter in particular is giving schools the direct message that they need to process each and every one of these cases. And they acknowledge that no one size fits all. And they acknowledge that consent is important. In fact, the Dear Colleague letter says schools should obtain the consent of a complainant before proceeding. And then it goes on to say when a complainant does request consent and does request confidentiality instead of proceeding, the schools may take that into consideration in determining what they need to do to ensure that there's a safe and non-discriminatory environment. And there are times when schools have to trump a complainant's request for consent. And that's in large measure what has victim advocate organizations very concerned about the direction and the message of the Dear Colleague letter. But I'd like to think of this as not an either or, not victim empowering or stepping on victims, but I like to look at this as, in the Jim Collins language, the genius of the and I think you can have both. It gets back to what Leslie said earlier about education in advance, so complainant victims know where to go to get complete confidentiality, and they know when they come to someone in the school administration or someone who's in a position to be responsible for this environment, that their privacy will be respected to the extent it can and will be trumped when safety of the community and a hostile environment is evident by the seriousness of the event, the pattern of behavior that we know may exist, the age of the complainant, and an accused right to be confronted with allegations to respond to that allegation. So it really isn't an either or, it is an and each scenario has to have a tailored fit based on using good judgment. And that's what schools are struggling with, how to adjust their processes and procedures to have the mechanics in place to get this done.
Well, let me turn to you, and I'm not a lawyer. This is clearly obvious, but I mean, we're talking about a crime or an alleged crime, are we not? If someone is sexually assaulted and they're not on a college campus, the police potentially gets involved in something like that.
Police potentially get involved in cases that happen on college campuses also.
Okay.
So we're absolutely, in most of these cases, talking about a crime. The student, victim, complainant, may choose not to report the matter to traditional law enforcement or may choose not to participate. No prosecutor's office will ever force a victim to come forward in a trial if she does not wish to do so. And I just want to say, we're talking she and he because that's what the typical numbers are, that statistically you're more likely to be a victim if you're a female than a male. But it's very clear that males are victims. We also have a significant number of same-sex assaults that occur between same-sex partners or same-sex individuals. But a student on a college campus, even if they do not report the case to law enforcement, the campus still has to investigate. The school has to investigate that incident. And the investigation doesn't need to be a traditional law enforcement model. It can be an investigation or an inquiry, if you will, that looks at, is the student safe? Are her needs being addressed? Did this event affect her ability to participate in her education here at our school? And what can we do as an institution to eliminate the harassment, to prevent its recurrence, and to address its effects?
So the goal is to create a safer campus for everybody, community for everybody.
Yes, absolutely. And the remedies that a school has are broad. They are as creative as the school chooses to be. You can do individual education or counseling. You can do counseling programs, say, for an athletic team, an athletic department, a Greek sorority system. You can change a student's schedule, her class schedule. You can change a student's living conditions. You can put no contact orders in place. They are as vast and limitless as smart, intelligent, intuitive individuals can come up with creative responses to how we move forward, preventing the reoccurrence and addressing the effects.
Allison, would you say that colleges and universities are doing a better job in more recent years?
Sure. I think, something that was said in the beginning of the program is that we're still talking about this a year later, the Dear Colleague letter. And I hope the conversation continues because it has certainly heightened awareness and the proactivity of colleges really seeking out training. I think that both Leslie and Gina are busy because campuses want to do something proactively as opposed to in reaction to. And I mean, quite frankly, administrators are busy on college campuses. Right. So the fact that you're seeing teams of people taking this seriously, wanting to tighten up their policies and their procedures is wonderful. Building up a coordinated community response is so important, bringing in the key players with an institution, and everybody has a certain role. I like how Gina mentioned using the and not the or, because there are people on campus whose role is student conduct, and to be impartial and to hear, and they're not victim advocates. Right. And then there's counselors and victim advocates on campus whose role is to provide that attention to the victim. And then there's public safety who have an investigatory role. So it's really important to understand. And from my own campus experience, it was a learning experience for me with a counseling victim advocacy background to hear from the director of student conduct say, well, I understand where you're coming from, but this is my role. And it was something that I certainly knew, but didn't appreciate until we really had a conversation about some of the reaction and understanding the dynamics. So there are really multiple layers that we need to look at. And so coordinating, having multiple people at the party, at the table, talk about this frequently is wonderful.
And Gina, do alleged perpetrators have rights under these rules and guidelines?
Absolutely. In fact, the Dear Colleague letter directs that the processes that handle sexual misconduct and sexual harassment allegations be balanced toward both sides, and colleges and universities must be Solomonic, must be balanced, and must provide the same supports for both sides, must provide the same rights through the process, must provide the same appeal rights. So absolutely.
And that's Gina Maisto-Smith, who joins us along with Leslie Gomez and Allison Kiss. And we are talking about the problem of sexual assaults on college campuses across the country and what is being done about it. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Sarah from West Philadelphia to join us. And Sarah, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, I was wondering if the panelists could talk a little bit about what procedural safeguards are in place for the accused in the college proceeding as compares to the procedural safeguards in place in the criminal proceeding. For example, whether attorneys should be allowed to be present in the college campus proceeding and sort of the implications of testimony in a campus proceeding as it relates to the criminal proceeding.
Sarah, that just picking up on what we were just talking about, can I toss that to you, Leslie?
Sure. So it's important to remember that student conduct processes and the Title IX processes are not courts. They're not designed to be courts. They don't have the ability to affect the loss of life or liberty. The student conduct processes are about evaluating whether or not a particular act violated the norms of the community that were put into place by the student handbook, by the institutional values, by the policies. Schools struggle with the issue as to whether or not attorneys should be allowed to be present in conduct hearings. And typically, what is important is that an advisor is appointed or chosen for the student. They can bring someone with them who can help them navigate the process, who can help them understand some of the nuances and the steps that are going to be involved, but is somebody who does not have a speaking role at the student conduct process itself. And so,
I just want to
I'm
add.
Sorry, I didn't mean to look away from you. Yeah,
that's
go ahead, Gina.
No, I just wanted to add to that. I think that in response to your question, caller, it will depend on the nature of the school. Public institutions, for example, have some due process issues that they have to tend to in their processes and procedures that private institutions don't. The key from the perspective of the Dear Colleague letter is that the procedures are fair, thorough, impartial, and balanced. And in many cases, you may have an attorney, you may not, depending on the school. So it really varies on the size of the school, the nature of the school, their policies, and their procedures.
And if someone is, in a sense, found guilty of some kind of, let's say, pretty serious sexual assault, what is the punishment under these guidelines? What happens to them?
Well, schools are free to set their own grievance procedures. They're free to set their own discipline. And in fact, if it is a crime, I believe most schools would like law enforcement to handle that and not become the court. But based on a complainant's request, it may go only to the student disciplinary procedure, which ranges from minor adjustments to a student's academic experience to expulsion.
Let me get, looks like Chelsea from East Falls to join us on Radio Times. And Chelsea, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I had an experience last year where I was sexually assaulted on. I was a college student at one institution, and I was sexually assaulted by a student from another college.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that.
And I tried to report it to the various institutions, but nothing really was able to happen. I wound up seeking traditional law enforcement out. But I was very disappointed to find that there was no way on either campus that I could voice my complaint. And my question really is that, you know, are we working on improving relationships between, you know, other college institutions so that, you know, other students don't get lost in these little cracks that we have?
Well, Chelsea, we're really sorry to hear what happened to you. And I'm just curious, who did you actually report to where you felt that it didn't go anywhere?
I went to counseling services, and I also spoke to public safety and also the public safety of the other institution.
Wow. So you, I mean, it sounds like you went to what feels like the appropriate places. I'm looking at you, Allison.
Sure.
Your thoughts?
No, I echo Marty's sentiments of being sorry for what happened to you and what happened with the process. Certainly sounds challenging. One of the things I would say is I have worked with institutions where perpetrator has been at another institution, and they've worked together to rectify that through the conduct process. And there are a number of vehicles, knowing that there's not only public safety, but other avenues on campus to report. And I think I commend you for sharing your story, because I think it helps others who are listening who may run into roadblocks to know that there are other places mm-hmm. that you can report on campus as well, from student conduct possibly or residence life.
Well, let me go back to you, Gina, knowing what you know about this dear colleague letter, Title IX, and all the rules and regulations you've been talking to colleges and universities about. What else could Chelsea have done?
Schools do struggle with this, particularly when they don't have jurisdiction over this particular student. If the student was not a member of Chelsea's campus, the school really has no teeth to discipline. And I do believe that in a case of a sexual assault, law enforcement under those circumstances is the best model, because it's very difficult for schools, and particularly the other school, while they may have some teeth over the individual, it didn't happen on their campus. The Dear Colleague letter really allows for schools to adapt and adjust to protect their students. So her school could mm-hmm. adapt and adjust and provide programs and support and counseling for Chelsea in her environment, but they really have no mm-hmm. ability to go after the other student from another campus. And I think law enforcement is best positioned for that.
Well, Leslie, does it make sense to have a one-size-fits-all policy or procedures so that there can be more coordination, or does it make sense for colleges and universities to come up with their own sets of policies and procedures?
There is no one-size-fits-all approach, and that's because we don't have cookie-cutter schools.
Right.
Every single school is different in its resources, its size, its student body composition, undergraduate, graduate. Some have religious overlays, some don't, and some are public, some are private. And right. you simply cannot create one policy that applies in each setting. What you can do is draw from the guidance that Title IX gives us, that comes in the 2001 guidance, that comes in the Dear Colleague letter, and identify the mandatory, the high level, the must that a school has to put in place. And then leave, once you have the broader message across, right. leave to each school the ability to fine-tune and create the procedures that work best for their context and their setting.
And are you seeing places where this is working?
Absolutely.
And that's the good news, I guess.
The good news is that a lot of college campuses are getting it right. The better news is that, by and large, folks on our campuses are well-intentioned. They want to do the right thing, and they're struggling hard to figure out exactly how to navigate this difficult path.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers. We're talking about what colleges and universities are doing to make their campuses safer, free from sexual assault. Talking with Leslie Gomez. She works in the litigation department of the Philadelphia law firm of Ballard Spahr. That's a voice you just heard. She joins us along with Gina Maisto-Smith, partner in the litigation department at the law firm of Ballard Spahr. Also with us is Allison Kiss, Executive Director of Security on Campus. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Temple University Libraries support WHYY and present their public programming series, Beyond the Page. On Tuesday, April 17th, Tom Finkelpearl will lead a discussion on public art and the process behind its creation. The series wraps up in early May with a Library Prize Award ceremony and a film screening of the documentary Reclaiming the Rust Belt. These are all open to the public with no ticket required. A complete schedule is available online at library.temple.edu.
We never really know the impact it has when we talk openly about something that's often seen as shameful. Maybe it creates a path for our own healing to begin. And maybe it lets others know they too can be heard and in turn supported. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, our relationship with our minds and our bodies as we head towards self-acceptance. That's today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
Support for WHYY is provided by Interact Theater Company's Outside the Frame Festival, a unique collection of seven premier productions by nationally known storytellers and solo artists sharing their stories about identity in America. Featured this week will be Palestine, in which Najla Saeed, daughter of eminent scholar Edward Saeed, tells of her travels to the occupied territories in order to discover her deeper identity as an Arab-American woman. Tickets and information for all festival events available at interacttheater.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. We're talking about the fact that about 20% of college students will be the victim of a sexual assault or attempted assault, and only a tiny fraction of them will actually report an incident of violence. The Obama administration decided to address the problem. In fact, the Education Department sent out a 19-page letter to colleges and universities about this time last year, telling them about their responsibility to deal with sexual misconduct. And today on the show, we're talking about what administrators, faculty, staff, and students can do to make college campuses safer. Lawyers Gina Maestro-Smith and Leslie Gomez are helping colleges establish policies and procedures and join us on Radio Times. Also with us is Allison Kiss, Executive Director of Security on Campus, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Allison, can you talk a little bit about bystanders and the role that bystanders can play on this issue?
Sure. You may need to cut me off because this is one of my favorite things to address. You know, one thing I like about the Dear Colleague letter is it really addresses the need to look at your climate on campus. When you have campuses with, we had a very well-known Ivy League campus where, you know, males were marching across campus yelling, no means yes, yes means anal. And you have this going on with some of our best and brightest. So really bringing in bystanders to sexual assaults, not everyone will be a victim of a sexual assault, not everyone will be a perpetrator, but everybody will know someone. So it's important. This stuff is happening at 1 a.m. off campus or on campus, wherever there's a party, and there are none of these administrators who are getting training there. So it's so
students.
Just students. So students really need to step up when they see something happening. And it's not easy to do. There's a lot of training and education out there. Men Can Stop Rape, most notably, has this campus strength program where they go out and they get men to really engage and buy into standing up if they see something wrong. One of the most moving things I've seen was at a Take Back the Night locally a year or so back, where we had a male stand up and talk about how he was an athlete, football player, quarterback at a school in Boston. He stood up and talked about how he started to get involved in this issue. He saw his friend sexually assaulted. He looked back and said, these are things that he could have done to maybe help that, to maybe talk to his male friend who was the perpetrator. And after that, to see some of the young men at this campus who were sitting in at the Take Back of the Night stand up and say, I had no intention to get up here and speak. Wow. But you know what? I've never assaulted anyone, but I've used the language. I've said some things that probably were offensive to women, whether it be in the locker room or amongst friends. And I'm really going to think about that next time. I'm going to challenge my friends, too.
So the idea that the bystanders who don't stand up are, in a sense, giving tacit approval or looking the other way?
Certainly. I mean, I wouldn't want to say approval, but I think that they have an obligation to their community. When you read a lot of missions of institutions that we're looking for, being, students for others, supporting each other, buying into this academic environment, mm-hmm. it extends to the social piece and really being sure to stand up if you see someone acting in a way that violates that code of conduct of the institution.
Either of you want to add? Gina, do you want to add anything to that?
Sure. The prevention element is really what has motivated Leslie and I 40 years between us in handling sexual misconduct as prosecutors. And so we're so thrilled to understand this push across campuses around bystanders. What we are seeing in our trainings when we're training law enforcement on campuses, whether we're training student affairs on campuses, whether we're helping rewrite policies and procedures, or even doing an investigation, what's becoming more and more apparent is that good investigations in this context require talking to the bystanders. So these investigations are really raising awareness that in word-against-word cases, we're not just looking at the he said, she said versions, we're looking at the attendant circumstances, and that invariably includes bystanders, it includes looking at social media, it includes looking at emails, and the web of folks that are involved in some awareness of these incidents gets wider and wider, which reinforces the preventive or prophylaxis of this, and that is good bystander training and awareness not only from the school administration and implementers, but those on the ground and in the weeds that are experiencing this from Thursday to Sunday.
And Leslie, what I hear throughout this hour, I've heard the word community. I mean, that we're talking about a community that involves obviously students and staff, faculty, administrators, but it's a community environment.
It is. And students, when they choose to join a particular institution, they sign on to that community environment. They sign on to that code of conduct. They sign on to those mores. And we hope that they are choosing schools that fit with who they are as an individual so that they can benefit from the educational system in the best way.
And I mean, it sounds like what is needed is our orientations. I mean, obviously for new students coming on campus, but I guess maybe reminders about how people are supposed to behave in a certain community environment.
Training should happen early and often. We should use everything that we know about good communication, primacy, recency. We should build a scaffolding of training such that there are written materials. There are things available on the internet or the web. We have interactive trainings and presentations. We really want to get the message to students in every way possible.
Let me get, looks like Russ from New Hope to join our conversation. And Russ, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yes, the one word that I haven't heard when you talk about community is fraternity. And
fraternity.
It's certainly true that at that college in upstate New York you just mentioned, and also the college in upstate New Hampshire that should be mentioned, that fraternities represent 40% to 60% of the social life at the college and the only organized social life, and yet they permit drinking to underage students, and they debauch their pledges by hazing. You recently saw the Rolling Stone article about Dartmouth, and this weekend the New York Times in their education section had a long piece on the fellow at Cornell that was killed in a drinking episode.
Russ, I'm sorry. You raise a very good point, and let me toss this first to Allison Kissin. And thanks for calling into Radio Times.
But it's the silence when you, as a girl or a boy, you come up against not only the passive silence of the whole fraternity organization, you come up against their community rules.
Indeed.
And you come up against their active denigration of your character.
Well, I appreciate the call and the way you said it, Russ. Let me give Allison a chance to weigh in. Go ahead.
Thank you, Russ. I think you raised some very good points, and what was interesting particularly about the Dartmouth scenario is you had a student come forward and say, this is wrong, in the student newspaper. And we need more students to do this. We could have administrators who are trained and know the laws inside and out and have the best procedures in place, but until those students engage. Westchester University in Pennsylvania has a wonderful bystander intervention program where they engage their fraternity members. The fraternity members participated in the videos. They show the videos at orientation. So it's breaking down that cultural belief that fraternities, sometimes athletes, are the perpetrators. I typically throw out the challenge. I know there are times that people will say, I come down hard on fraternities and athletes. We know they're higher risk populations. And I throw out the challenge to debunk that myth, to stand up when you see something going on. And it's important to change the culture. Dr. Robert Carruthers is someone I've admired for a while. He went in as the president of University of Rhode Island when University of Rhode Island had this background of being the number one party school in the country, I think 2 years in a row from Playboy magazine. And he went in and changed that. And there was a belief that alumni wouldn't donate and that people would not come to football games. And he made some really hard decisions. And it's an interesting case study that I hope a lot of institutions will look at when they're having that trouble institutionalizing something.
Leslie, you want to add to that?
So I think Allison makes a great point, and that's we really need to look at what message we're giving out as an administration and as a university. Because if we have a code of conduct that is adhered to, that has swift and certain consequences for bad behavior, that's going to drive and change our campus behavior in a better way. On the other hand, if we have an institution that turns a blind eye to out-of-control fraternity parties or underage alcohol use, students will continue to believe that they have a license to do so. It's no different than good parenting, if you will, that if you are the permissive parent, your child will continue to push the boundaries. But if you are firm and respectful, set the ground rules out in advance, and hold your children, your youth, your students accountable, you'll have a much better result.
But and just picking up on this, Gina, but looking at fraternities or even athletic departments, is it a challenge to get them on board with what we've been talking about?
Absolutely. And what we've seen in the national conversation is colleges and universities are silo environments. And athletics, for example, has some NCAA rules. Fraternities have their own rules. So the challenge is getting everyone to the table. And what we have seen is schools that are doing it, and there are many schools that are doing it well, they bring everyone to the table. They bring all of the policies to the table. Often we have policies that live in 12 different places that say different things and that are malaligned. And that malalignment sends mixed messages. And so it's very clear to me that we do need coordination. It's very clear to me that we do need to get those silos broken down and create what the chief compliance officer at NYU says, cylinders of excellence.
So, as opposed to these silos. But that's administration, right? Isn't it? I mean, as Allison was saying, a president comes in and says, we're not going to be the number one drinking school in the country.
Absolutely. This Dear Colleague letter, the Penn State situation, and other high-profile situations have really put the focus where it needs to be at a very high level, and is that call to action, and it's getting the attention of presidents and boards and administrators to get the right people to the table and invest in this, and schools are doing it.
Let me get Zach from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times, and Zach, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. It's a very interesting show.
Thank you.
I am a student at a small liberal arts college, a top small liberal arts college outside of Philadelphia. I don't want to say it by name. But I'm calling to report that the situation surrounding sexual assault is, well, laughable at best and despicable at worst. My perspective as an acquaintance sexual assault prevention team member has been that we do train our students to engage in active consent and, not to be perpetrators. But at the same time, when a survivor does come forward, they go to the administration, and because the administration has to report based on the Clery Act and because of the Title IX, rules, instead they engage in victim blaming, asking questions like, what were you wearing that night? How much did you have to drink? How many sexual partners have you had in the past? Which effectively silences the survivors and makes them feel like they have nowhere to go. And this story has been replicated by so many of my friends that it's angering. And I think it comes from the fact that schools, small schools like the one I attend, want to replicate this myth that, it's a small, tight-knit community and sexual assault can happen here. And so instead of really addressing the issue in a comprehensive way, they just silence survivors, which is despicable. I'll take my response off the air.
Zach, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I guess, Gene, I'm looking at you. I'll start with you. Go ahead.
Sure. First and foremost, most schools and even Zach's school has a policy and a process and procedure in place, and we know that complainant went there. You may be talking the talk in your policy and procedure, but if you are not appropriately trained with the appropriate background knowledge about sexual assault and the dynamics of sexual assault, victimization, counterintuitive victim behaviors, the myths, and the investigative techniques that are different from any other kind of crime, unless your folks are properly trained in that, you're going to have the result that Zach has on his campus, and that is the perception, not the reality, because they have all the process and procedure in place, but the perception that the process and procedure drives victims away. So what's the answer? The answer is good training. Mm. What's the answer? Competent folks. Folks who have experience in handling sexual misconduct. What winds up happening in many schools is that they do look for outside support before a case goes to a conduct board, so that a conduct board is properly trained before they hear about a sexual assault. And we see that happening all over the country.
We've had a couple of calls, though, Allison, of people complaining about problems with the system that, well, maybe on paper it's supposed to operate in a certain kind of way. In reality, It doesn't, and I think our Zach's call really underscores that, and also that a university might be afraid of reporting for fear of damaging their reputation.
Sure, and to echo what Gino said, I think a lot of it, there could be wonderful policies, but if an institution isn't adhering to the policy or their procedures, it's certainly flawed. And many times, it's unfortunate, but when I hear something like what Zach's saying, it may be one or two people who may not have that knowledge, and it's quite damaging to the university response if that's the perception of the students. I would encourage Zach to really, it's clear he's a leader already, but to demand change. And what's great about our colleges and universities, our students do have a say. We saw it at Dickinson University last year where students protested how sexual assaults were being handled, and the administration stayed up all hours of the night to meet with students and really worked with the students to champion some of the changes that they needed to make. So I think it can happen. So his frustration is evident, but I would certainly say reach out and look for some, and I know all of us around the table here, sure, some resources to help encourage that change and leave your mark when you leave.
And we have about 45 seconds. Leslie, go ahead.
So the important piece is the process. Is the process fair? Is it equitable? Do you approach the witnesses, the victims, and the accused with a sense of openness, impartiality, and really take the time to listen, to understand, and to treat all individuals fairly? Not everyone is going to be satisfied with every result. And in fact, in 100% of the cases that a university handles, at least 50%, if not more, will be unhappy with the result. But can we at least arrive at a result that is balanced, that is equitable, that is fair, and that is based on what we know from decades and decades and decades of handling, responding to sexual misconduct allegations?
Well, much more to talk about, but the clock tells me we're out of time. And my thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. The voice you just heard is Leslie Gomez. She works in the litigation department of the Philadelphia law firm of Ballard Spahr. Also with us, Gina Maisto-Smith. She's a partner in the litigation department at Ballard Spahr. And our third guest, Allison Kiss, executive director of security on campus. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thank you.
You can go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.